Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello and welcome, and happy Sunday to you. And I'm going to say Happy New Year again. I said Happy New Year last week on the first show of the new season, but man, I think it's still fair for me to say Happy New Year to you all. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. I walked into the lobby right off the studio this afternoon, and for the first time, this radio station has done what it should have done a long time ago, which is put a display case in the lobby with all of the trophies that they've won for being the best radio station in the state for all these years. Congratulations, WCHL. Last week on the first show of the new year, I set up a topic that we're going to explore maybe a half a dozen more times over the next 4 to 5 months. And that is, I mean, I have to admit, I feel a little sheepish when I say this. I feel like maybe, Nordgren, you're a little full of yourself. The topic is that political and community leaders will serve us better now and in the future when they integrate into their governance and into their policymaking the creative and entrepreneurial ideas and practices and concepts that I've collected in my new book, Common Ground for Us. It's due out in June. Now, I'm covered. You know, this sheepishness actually kept me quiet for a while. I thought, hey, Nordgren, you're not the guy to help political leaders and community leaders improve their work. That's never been your world. But I found a phrase that covered me and that emboldened me, and that phrase is, in times of fierce cynicism, it demands a radical naivete. So please hear that I've embraced that I'm pretty naive about all of this. So last week I shared some foundational concepts. The number one concept was that we need common ground. Our nation needs common ground. Our political conversations need to take place on common ground. And I have inadvertently discovered it, the common ground that I believe we need. I looked at it for 15 years before I saw it for what I now see it to be. I've told people for nearly 20 years about the research that showed that 98% of us at the age of 4 and 5 years old score at NASA's creative genius level on creativity assessment tools. 98% of us, I've shared that with 10,000 entrepreneurs and scientists and engineers and lawyers and military leaders, and I can assure you that this common ground that 98% of us occupy is as attractive to the left as it is to the right. As I talked about last week, on this common ground, we find the most rational and the most optimistic. It's both the most rational and the most optimistic stories of preparation for a future of unknowable unknowns. That's our future, folks, the future that we share. I guess that's more common ground that we all are living our way into. We need to make our way in this future of unknowable unknowns. Why is it that? Because it's going to be a future. It is a future of constant change. There'll be more fierce disruptions. There's going to be unimaginable technology breakthroughs. I spent a little bit more time sharing all that with you last week. I shared with you last week what futurists say, professional futurists say about the future when they send their 5 or their 10-year plan to their client, and they say that their most likely scenario isn't very likely. So facing that unknowable future, on this common ground, we find ways to prepare for it that are rational. Isn't it rational to become more adaptive, become better at collaboration, to be more ingenious? What's ingenious? What do I mean by that? Doing what you can with what you have, get better at pattern recognition. It's rational that we would develop those qualities facing an unimaginable future. But it's also optimistic because this is who we are. This plays to our strengths. This is who we are. So that on that common ground, we find the most rational and the most optimistic stories to prepare for an unknowable future. On that common ground, we also find a strategically important way to think about commonwealth. Commonwealth being the aggregation of resources in a fashion that each of us benefit and all of us benefit from the most effectively and most efficient use of those resources. I shared three examples of what I meant by commonwealth last week. Let me quickly summarize one of them, which is a new business incubator. Ask 10 first-time entrepreneurs, do you want to start your business by yourself or do you want to come together? Well, you will bring your contacts. You'll bring your resources, your knowledge, as will the other founders. And you'll share that you'll aggregate your knowledge and your contacts and your resources. You'll aggregate that into commonwealth, and each of you benefits from sharing that. I urge political leaders to think, when they're considering public schools, to see them as commonwealth, the community's commonwealth, and to couple that shift in perception about what public schools are. And they're really important. Public schools are so important sources of commonwealth for a neighborhood, for a community. All kinds of research that shows that a vibrant public school improves property values. Crime is reduced. There's just such wonderful reasons to invest in that commonwealth, and that's the operative word. Don't spend money for schools. Invest in schools. When you're spending, you want to minimize what you spend, right? But when you invest and you find success, boy, you want to keep on investing, right? Keep on. You want to measure that success, and when you find it, you want to keep on investing. Now, something that's radically changed in the last two or three years since I began exploring the application of these ideas into political leadership, one major thing that's changed is, you know, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, people sometimes didn't quite get my sense that universal basic income was coming and that the best thing political leadership could do in the face of that is to prepare for that is to help us be our most creative. Well, I don't have any problem helping people see that UBI is coming. It's on the horizon. I'm not predicting when it will be here, but it's clear that it will arrive. When 70% of a business's expenses are employee-related, right? Salaries and wages and benefits and costs associated with hiring somebody and employing somebody, 70% of business expenses are in that category. So businesses are going to be highly motivated to apply all workplace automation that they can, AI, robotics. And at some point, so many jobs are going to be stripped out of the economy that the marketplace's ability to purchase these highly profitable goods and services will begin to erode, and it will be in businesses' self-interest to have a universal basic income so that they have a market for their goods and services. And when you come back from the break, I'm going to talk to you about how political leadership can prepare us for this day.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back, and thanks for coming back. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius. In the first segment, we're revisiting the first episode that we had of this year, which is me sharing the creative ideas, the entrepreneurial principles that I believe political leadership should consider in their governance, in their policy making. The first segment of the show, I sort of reminded us of some of the foundations. I've just introduced us to the phenomena of universal basic income. I believe it's inevitable that there's a universal basic income on the horizon. What if political leadership gets ahead of this phenomena and brings an all-hands-on-deck level of importance to investing in our preparation for the advent of universal basic income? Take it out of the phenomena of being just another welfare stipend, even if it's absolutely required, it'll be dismissed as such. And instead, let's see it as an investment. An investment in what? What if leaders were to invest in programs that are focused on helping each and every one of us grow our creative and our entrepreneurial qualities and become our most creative selves, and called on schools to bring the creativity into the education, community colleges, service organizations, the Rotary Clubs, Lion Club, all those clubs. Political leadership should be urging them to embrace the importance of cultivating us in our creative and our entrepreneurial expressions and knowledge. Well, what if they went a step further and not only developed this human creative capital, but invested in, let's call them, Commonwealth utilities? Creative and productive Commonwealth utilities. What do I mean by that? I've got four examples of a Commonwealth utility that I think that political leaders should be investing in. The first is very familiar to many of you, I'm sure, and that's makerspaces, right? Makerspaces provide the technology and the tools and the supplies, traditional hand tools and craft tools and supplies, 3D printers, laser cutters, design software, looms, sewing machines. The collection of resources is usually adapted to the particular region's interest. Sometimes they're staffed by skilled people who can also mentor. Sometimes the mentoring is peer-to-peer. But investing in makerspaces. When makerspaces were first a phenomenon a few years back, I got excited about them and attended a couple of makerspace conferences. And what I heard time and again was that when somebody starts to make their own item in a makerspace, right, it's something that they need, right, a part to replace a part that's always wearing out, to replace, you know, to make a tool that they can't find anymore, that they frequently find other people are in need of that same part, that same tool. And the phrase that apparently you hear frequently in the hallways of makerspaces is, and then before you know it, I was in business for myself providing this tool, this part, to other people. And so makerspaces for sure are an example of this Commonwealth productive utility that that political leadership should be investing in. New venture incubators is another. I mentioned those a moment ago, the importance of new venture incubators. How about wet labs for biotech startups? That's another great place, again, depending upon the region, the interest within a region. But wet labs would be another great investment that political leaders should be leading us to. Commercial kitchens would be another. And so with a commitment to growing our human capital and the commitment to investing in these tools, when you now add that universal basic income, when that now comes along, we'll have I can imagine that we'll have this bottoms-up grassroots renaissance when people get to do what they love to do, and we provide them with the education to help them develop their extraordinary qualities, and we invest in the tools to help them apply their extraordinary qualities, we're going to have this amazing bottoms-up grassroots renaissance that I just get so excited when I spend any time considering it. So political leadership also serves us by talking about this, by telling us stories about this. I came across a fellow from the late 1700s. Andrew Fletcher was a Scottish writer and patriot. And his quote is, if I could write the ballads for a people, I care not who would write the laws of that nation. I care not who would write the laws of that nation. Ballads, of course, are stories set to music. And so if a political leader tells the stories about how we're going to achieve and become this extraordinary nation, then then the laws will follow. I experienced this a little bit. I was heading up a company called Cellular One of the Triangle. Some of you older folks might remember that in 1985, we introduced cellular to this market for the first time. Well, we wound up building and operating about 14, 15 cellular companies across the Southeast. And what we quickly figured out was that these core stories that Cellular One had created, internal stories that kept us moving in the right direction, marketplace stories that helped made promises to customers that we then had to keep, right? We had a collection of stories that really helped us manage ourselves. So we told these new companies, these new operations that were part of our network, we're not going to tell you how to run your local business. All you have to do is embrace these stories. Tell these stories in your market, and the policies and the programs that are more appropriate for your market will emerge, and you'll find the right way to do what you want to do as long as you're true to these stories. We know that stories guide. We know that stories inspire. I've spent some time studying the concept of aspirational stories, stories that help make themselves come true, and they make themselves come true. They're usually got about three parts to an aspirational story. The first part is a true, honest presentation of our current situation, right? We all have to begin at a common understanding of where we are today. Another part of the aspirational story is that dramatic picture of where we want to go, that better world that we all want to achieve. And then the third part of the aspirational story are the stories about how we get there, the stories that illuminate the behaviors and the understanding of how we are going to get there. We need political leaders telling us aspirational stories about our unknowable future.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. Today I've been talking about these ideas and concepts that I believe that political leadership will be well served by when they integrate some of these ideas into their governance, into their policymaking. I'm going to talk about this a couple more times over the next few months. The next couple of shows, I just want to tell you, will be with guests. The show next week will be with a gentleman who, when he retired 10 years ago, was considered one of the foremost experts on sleep in our nation. And boy, I'll bet we could all benefit from a little bit of better understanding of how to get the best night's sleep that we can get. But he also talks about the creative aspects of sleep. And then the fellow 2 weeks from now will be the gentleman when he wrote his book back in the 80s. He coined the phrase and was one of the first pioneers in studying the phenomena of near-death experience. So we'll have him 2 weeks from now. Today, let's finish up this last segment by talking about some of the creative and entrepreneurial concepts that we should be investing ourselves in for our own preparation of an unknowable future. I'll begin with social capital. Social capital networks is that network of all your friends and associates and former partners and former co-employees, all the folks that you know, the suppliers for your company, all these folks are in your social capital network. Research shows that the most creative people in an organization are those people that have got the most diverse, most robust, most dynamic social capital network. And the very best way to grow your social capital network is by being generous to the folks in your network, right? Sharing ideas with them, sharing links to articles that you think they'd want to read, introducing somebody to them that they would benefit from knowing. The human condition is such is that when you're generous with me, my reaction is I want to be generous in return. And so when you build your social capital network with the currency of generosity, you've got all these friends and allies who are eager to be generous in return with you, to be early scouts for changes, be early lookouts for opportunity for you. So intentionally growing your social capital network as we move into the future of unknowable unknowns, as you prepare yourself to make your way in that unknowable future, has got to be on the top of your list of the creative quality that you want to cultivate in yourself. Closely related to that is to be a good collaborator, right? In some ways, collaboration is a microcosm of social capital, right? You want to bring people together and have them work effectively together. Boy, the number one successful tool, approach for you to take in successful collaboration is to be a really good listener, to listen to the very best of what people are saying, to be a generous listener, to be an appreciative listener. When people in this collaborative team bring their ideas, listen for the very best of them. Be the collector of the very best of what people are saying, right? Some creative work is done singularly. When I write a novel, I'm pretty much writing that all by myself. But most creative work is done in a team, is done in a collaborative team. And we need to get better and better at making, at effectively engaging in creative work. Being a great collaborator is really important part of that. Won't your ability to be a good, have good ability at recognizing patterns? That'll be awfully important as we face an unknowable future. Wouldn't you agree? And your pattern recognition skills can be improved. When you're 20 and 30 and 40 years old, you have really good pattern recognition skills. It's called fluid intelligence, and it really is strong when you're 30 years old, where you can see the patterns and the logic of a situation. When we get to be 50, 60, and like me, 70 years old, our pattern recognition skills atrophy a little bit. Instead, our crystallized intelligence takes over. But we can develop better pattern recognition. Research shows that you can improve your pattern recognition. One of the ways to do it is to have some fun going online and playing one of the match three games that you can find online in lots of different guises. Playing with those that match three world improves your pattern recognition ability, research shows. In the analog world, I urge people to be looking for patterns as they're, let's say, driving from here to there. Find the pattern in the license plate that's in front of you. Find the pattern in the addresses that you go by. Find the pattern in the conversations that you're hearing from people. You know, what are you hearing in one conversation that shares a pattern with what you're hearing in a conversation a couple of days later? So be mindful of pattern recognition opportunities. And you got to be mindful, if you're going to be good at pattern recognition, at busting the status quo, right? The status quo is so powerful that when you look at a new pattern, your brain is going to want to show it to you as an old pattern. So you need many perspectives. That's why one of the ways you practice being really good at pattern recognition is intentionally take many perspectives. Look at it from above. Look at it from below. Look at it when you're tired. Look at it when you're happy. Engage in intentional busting of the status quo. That'll improve your pattern recognition. Folks, I hope you come back for the next couple of weeks. I got some great guests for you, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Take care.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.